are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 23rd, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor at Yale Law School, James Whitman, on Hitler's American model, the United States, and the making of Nazi race law. Also on the program today, Trump in Arizona. Maybe a little bit redundant. Claims a government shutdown if there is no funding for his magic wall. Meanwhile, Rex Tillerson clarifies the Afghanistan policy. There'll be no winning, only killing. And Marcellus Williams' execution stayed by the governor following DNA evidence. Meanwhile, jury selection in the Menendez case starts today. The senator on trial in New Jersey, folks, and a lot of legislation could be in the balance. And, of course, the question on everyone's minds has always been, is there a pee tape? Well, the dossier compiler testifies for 10 hours in front of the Senate yesterday. Meanwhile, the other dossier compiler, Steele, has been talking to Mueller and explaining his sources. Meanwhile, Donald Trump thinks Mitch McConnell is a loser. And Mitch McConnell thinks Donald Trump is a dick.
Not the good kind.
Breitbart. Breitbart gets burned. And Governor LePage still exists. All this and more, ladies and gentlemen, total insanity. Total insanity. Over the past 24 hours. FYI, I will be heading out on vacation. We will have all new shows for you. Tomorrow will be live. Part of it will be a pre-taped interview that I did. Part of it will be Michael jibber-jabbering away. And then Friday will also be a show. And then next week we have some really fascinating interviews with you that we have pre-recorded. You will enjoy them. And, of course, members will get material, not only the new material, the interview material that we have, but also deep archive stuff. So we're going deep into the archives. Archives that, frankly, you can't find anywhere. Some of which you can, but mostly not. So become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Let's just play this. last night, Donald Trump spoke in Arizona. We're not going to harangue you with too many clips. There was also very peaceful protests outside of the event last night. Thousands of people, but, and I was watching this on CNN at one point. They had a reporter there. All of a sudden, the reporter's like, there has been no violence, and he is literally choking on tear gas that has been thrown into the crowd by the police. It's very bizarre. And also, I think he's also got to learn the meaning of violence. If someone's throwing tear gas at you just because they're the cops, doesn't mean that there's no violence there.
I saw a protester kick back the tear gas and they shot him.
We have a clip of that and we will play that in a bit.
That counts as violence.
Yes. But I think just the initial throwing of tear gas should be noted as violence. Nevertheless, here is, I don't know which one of these crazy things if we should do. This is the most important thing, the most non, and of course the big narrative today was that Donald Trump is insane. And frankly, I will say this, and we'll talk about this more in the so-called fun half. Last night, I mean, look, this is a speech that he could have given or did give literally tens, if not, I don't know, not hundreds, but probably 50 times at least during the campaign. But the reaction last night was near universal, and the sort of the drum beats to get rid of this guy on a day when the New York Times came out with a very big piece about the fight between Donald Trump and Mitch McConnell, where McConnell basically, he doesn't say this directly, people, sources around McConnell, and the way this works is, folks, is that when you get sources around McConnell saying something that McConnell said, that is a calculated, you know, this is not by accident. This is to get the message out. And the message out was McConnell basically says, like, I don't think his president, there's a chance his presidency can't survive. And impeachment is not inconceivable, particularly if he keeps attacking the members of my Senate caucus. And then you get all this. So it's interesting to see the narrative around this building. I don't know if it means anything. But the most important thing that came out of the speech, aside from the guy over his right shoulder who shows up in a lot of rallies and has a crazy website and all the sheer insanity that he exhibited last night, was that Donald Trump, and we saw this in the transcript of his conversation with the Mexican president, Donald Trump knows that delivering on the wall, progress on the wall, even if it's just nominal, is essential to maintaining his support with the loons who will show up at his rallies. And he is basically saying, and remember, we have a debt ceiling supposedly going to be crossed sometime in late September. We also have a budget that needs to be approved. He's basically saying, if there is no funding for the wall, nice government you have there, but it's going to go away.
And we are building a wall on the southern border, which is absolutely necessary. Build that wall. Now, the obstructionist Democrats would like us not to do it, but believe me, if we have to close down our government, we're building that wall. Let me be very clear to Democrats in Congress who oppose a border wall and stand in the way of border security. You are putting all of America's safety at risk. You're doing that. You're doing that.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that he doesn't need Democratic votes to pass a budget. They're going to pass the budget through the reconciliation bill, and that's, they don't need Democrats for that. But I guess this is his way of setting the table. So that's the biggest news that came out of the speech last night. We'll play other clips in a bit. Meanwhile, have you inherited an old coin collection? Do you have an accumulation of coins or currency you're not sure what to do with? Can't keep them in your sock? Can't keep them in that shoebox for the rest of your life? Littleton Coin is here to help. Over 70 years, Littleton Coin has been helping people just like you sell their coins and currency As an industry leader in collectible coins and currency, Littleton can pay you more. Did you know that, like, Matt, I know Michael doesn't know this and Kelly doesn't know this.
How do you know?
But you just don't have the numismatic quality about you. Like the $5 bills, maybe those other bills, but they were, you could actually take them down and hand them in at the bank for silver. They were silver certificates.
I was unaware.
Yeah, not that long ago. I've seen a couple of those. They were like blue, which was a very strange thing. Now the, you know, the currency is all sorts of different, you know, almost like Europeanish. But back in the day, see a blue $5 bill. That was weird. In 2016, David Sundeman, he is the company's president, received an ANA, that's the American Numismatic Association, Dealer of the Year Award. And Littleton Coin was honored with the Better Business Bureau Torch Award for Marketplace Ethics. So the most important thing about any type of collectible dealer, that they're people you can trust and have some integrity. Whether you're an experienced collector or someone who needs help identifying what you have in your collection, Littleton Coin Company is the place to sell your U.S. coins and currency. The process is incredibly simple. All you got to do, visit littletoncoin.com/majority to learn more. Or you can give them a call, toll-free, 877-857-7850. Tell them the Majority Report sent you. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to James Whitman, author of Hitler's American Model, The United States, and the Making of Nazi Race Law. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program James Q. Whitman. He is a professor of comparative and foreign law at Yale Law School. He is also the author of Hitler's American Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to start with something to sort of a broader question, because about the, just the notion of law. What can you describe the concept of legal innovation?
Gee, that is a broad question. Well, the United States, American law in particular, is unusually innovative. Most legal traditions pretty much stick with the sorts of rules and solutions that they've stuck with forever. And it takes a and show what, from the American point of view, looks like a kind of lack of imagination. American law is very, very different from that in many, many areas. American contract law, for example, is very creative. We came up with forms of contracts that permitted the rise of the biotech industry when nobody else did. American corporate law is very creative, too. And in the early 20th century, as I say in my book, American race law was very creative. We did things nobody else had quite thought of or tried to put into effect.
And I ask that, obviously, because, you know, your book outlines how when the Nazis came to power, they were searching for a way to codify their agenda, particularly as it dealt with race. And so they were searching around rather than sort of start from whole cloth. And you also document that, you know, in the years before Hitler took power, there was already some sense of looking to the United States and how they dealt with race and such issues. And so let's for just give us an outline of like what they were looking for. Like, why couldn't the Nazis just have said, hey, this is what we're going to do? I mean, why did they need to look for something to build upon?
Well, I mean, of course, it's possible they could have just done it. They didn't, in fact. But, you know, historians always avoid counterfactuals. We don't know what would have happened if what did happen didn't happen. But the fact of the matter is that they went and looked for any foreign models they could find. I mean, they did research on the race law found all over the world at the time. But as you say, it was really the America that they lit on as the great example. And as you also have said, that was something that the interest in America had been there and the far right wing in Europe for a very long time before the Nazis came along. You know, why did the Nazis seize on the U.S.? Part of the answer, I think, is an answer about law, and part of the answer is an answer about Nazism. I mean, as a matter of law, it's both difficult to come up with legal innovations and of the kind that American law had come up with, and a little bit uncomfortable to do things without some kind of a precedent, even for Nazis. You want to be able to point to somebody who did it before you. As for why the Nazis were interested in America, it didn't just involve American law, of course. The U.S. was the dominant, wasn't the hyperpower it is now, but it had emerged from World War I as the great power, as a great continental empire of the kind the Nazis wanted to make Germany into. It was, of course, a tremendous commercial and cultural power as well. And naturally, the Nazis, being Nazis, gave the credit to American racism for all this American success. Those are also reasons why they look to the U.S., I think.
And I don't want to belabor this too much, but from a layperson's perspective, right? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, why? Because I think when people think of Nazis, I mean, I think they just think, well, I mean, these guys are bad people. Why would they need precedent? Why would there still be a sort of, you know, what is the importance of the notion of rule of law, I guess, and the idea that there's precedent? How is that helpful to people who are starting to sort of develop a society, I guess?
Well, you know, I think part of the answer, these are really deep questions that you're asking, of course. And I'm not completely confident that I'll give fully satisfactory answers when people have wondered about them for generations, but I'll try. You know, part of the answer had to do with the Nazis' need for broad public support. You know, the Nazis were, of course, extraordinarily threatening to ordinary Germans, to anybody who didn't want to go along. Nevertheless, as we see, as we witness in the United States today, I won't make too much of the comparison, the Nazis had to work with a bureaucracy. They had to work with people who were really quite prepared to sign on to the full Nazi program. And the appeal to law mattered for those purposes. They needed the cooperating figures of power and who were not Nazis themselves. I think that's part of the reason that they felt they needed to offer the world a facade of rule of law, if you want to put it that way. I think there are other reasons as well. Lawyers, for whatever reason, were disproportionately favorable to the Nazi party. There were a lot of lawyers, a lot of prominent lawyers, became convinced Nazis. And these lawyers were, of course, trained in the law, and you tend to stick with what you've been trained to do. And we see this when we look at the records. They were trying to figure out a way to make Nazism work using the tools they had learned as law students.
Yeah, I mean, I ask because I think that's, I mean, a really important dynamic, not just in sort of, you know, how the states become fascist in some respects, but we've also seen it in the context of other things that happen, you know, particularly under, let's say, the Obama administration, the idea of taking things and codifying them in law that other, you know, that the prior administration had done just simply, you know, based on a broader principle, let's say. But with that said, let's talk about how this law was developed. I mean, I guess what they were seeking. Well, tell us about this 1934 Commission on Criminal Law Reform, because you literally lay out almost like the minutes of these meetings. And why? What was happening there that was so important? What were they discussing?
You know, they are the minutes, exactly. We have a stenographic transcript of what was said in this planning meeting for what would eventually become the Nuremberg Laws in 1935. Now, I should, as background, I should make it clear that in the early years of the Nazi regime, the Nazis were not yet imagining the Holocaust or mass murder. This was not something that they could have practically considered, and it's not something they really talked about. They were interested in law. They were interested in producing what emerged in the Nuremberg Laws, namely, first, a form of second-class citizenship for Jews, and second, a bar on interracial marriage and interracial sex, and indeed a criminalization of interracial marriage and interracial sex. They wanted these things done in the right way. At this meeting in particular, they were discussing a variety of topics, but most especially the second aspect of the Nuremberg Laws, that is the criminalization of interracial sex and interracial marriage. They had, when the meeting began, the transcript shows, the first thing that happened, essentially, was that the justice minister presented a memorandum on American law that had been prepared by the ministry for purposes of the discussion. Why American law? It's because particular American law really stood out, especially for its criminalization of interracial marriage, but also for the elaborate character of the American law classifying who belonged to which race. The Nazis couldn't find the Nazis had been pushing for the criminalization of interracial marriage for quite a while before they had come to power already. But it was very difficult to point to any example elsewhere in the world that resembled anything like what they were planning. The U.S. offered it, and at that particular meeting, we see them talking in a great deal of detail about American anti-miscegenation statutes, that is, statutes forbidding and criminalizing interracial marriage, from all over the country. There were 30 of them at the time. The Nazis weren't just looking at the southern states. They were looking at Minnesota and the state of Washington and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's when you look at this transcript that it becomes impossible to avoid the conclusion that the U.S. really, the Nazi understanding and interest in American law played a real role in the making of the Nuremberg Laws.
And it turns out that in the context of anti-miscegenation and the sort of the definition of races, American law at that time, anyways, for these Nazis was too harsh.
Isn't it a shocker?
Yeah,
there were various aspects of American law that went too far for the Nazis. The prime example is the so-called one-drop rule. This is a rule in some, not all states, according to which any individual with one drop of black blood counted as black. The Nazis astoundingly referred to this as an example of excessive human hardness. How can you do that to these poor people? They said there were other things, too, that they found strange, over the top. They looked at segregation and thought some of it was a bit wild. Why would you separate the races on the tax rolls, for example? What sense does that make? America to them was going too far a lot of the time.
And before we talk about sort of the concept of second-class citizens and in immigration, let's jump across the Atlantic at that time and give us a sense. I mean, oddly, a lot of this is particularly relevant, over the past couple of months, I guess. And I have to say that what struck me as I was reading through your book was 3 weeks ago, was it? I don't know. I've lost all sense of time. Where Stephen Miller, when he was up announcing the new immigration laws in a press conference, and was questioned, as to was accused of being anti-American in some respect in the promulgation of these laws. He said, "You guys don't know your history. This is fairly consistent with where we've been, throughout American history." So let's talk about in this era. This would be, sort of the 1920s, early 30s, but even in prior to that, and then following it. What was the state of? First, let's talk about the Plessy v. Ferguson and Jim Crow, but also immigration.
Sure. Well, immigration matters a lot more than most of us remember, except maybe Stephen Miller and others. American immigration law was of great interest to right-wingers, once again, in Europe. Hitler praised American immigration law himself in Mein Kampf. and others had done the same thing for a long time. American immigration had generally been quite open through the middle of the 19th century. In the latter part of the 19th century, though, things began to shift. First of all, in reaction to the appearance of Chinese who were brought in to work on the railroad and so on and so forth, there was a lot of concern about keeping the Chinese out, and then other Asians as well. In the early 20th century, and particularly in the 20s, there was a new turn, and there were two statutes in the 1920s, especially the statute of 1924, which introduced the so-called national quota system. This was a system with more or less open racializing or racist aims, intended to keep out especially Eastern Europeans, including Jews, of course, Southern Europeans, and favor the classic, or regarded as the classic WASP candidates for American citizenship. Those particular statutes in the 1920s remained on the books into the 1960s. So, you know, it's not only at the very end of the civil rights era that American immigration law moved away from these traditions of racial classification and of maintaining the right race mix in the population, or not much of a mix at all.
How did they do that? What was the surrogate? If they didn't use race explicitly, what was the mechanism which they did to arrive at the race they wanted in terms of?
Well, sometimes they did. I mean, there was a thing, for example, called the Asian Barred Zoned Act. I forget. You know, when it came to Asians, they would talk expressly about the races. When it came to others, what they did was to have national quotas. So there was a base year. I think it may have been 1919. I don't remember. And further immigration was limited by reference to that base year. It was never fully shut off. But the justifications given for this were, you know, quite, as was typical of the early 20th century, quite frankly, race-based justifications. You know, what has happened since the end of the 1960s does, to that extent, represent a real and dramatic shift in American immigration policy. That is certainly true.
And so, and where were we in terms of, I mean, you say the Nazis looked to 30 different states for anti-miscegenation laws. What, did they have any issue with, I mean, was there any sort of legalistic questions surrounding the idea of like state laws versus a federal law? Did that come to play at all? And how did they sort of integrate those two bodies, or were they just looking for just any type of precedent?
Not very much. I mean, so the couple of Nazis who really knew American law well understood the problems in distinguishing state from federal law. But in the discussions I talk about, the topic is really generally just the United States or America, with relatively little sense. They were certainly aware that although, for example, there were 30 states with anti-miscegenation laws on the books, there were obviously 18 at the time that didn't. They knew there was a huge variety in American law. They knew there was inconsistency in American law. What they typically said about this variety and inconsistency was that the Americans, although they clearly had gotten the right idea, they'd achieved the fundamental recognition, as the basic Nazi handbook put it, were nevertheless not being sufficiently rigorous in carrying out the race program. Their hope or intention, of course, was that the Nazi regime would be much more rigorous about doing the same thing, and that's the way they tended to talk about it, not tolerating any such regional differences or backsliding, or for that matter, the existence of constitutional norms of the American kind that ran contrary to American race policy, because there were such constitutional norms as well.
So substantively, they felt we were on the right track. We just we were failing in terms of a competency or a process.
So they differed over that. Some of them, Hitler himself, was unusually optimistic about the future of the United States in the 1920s and early 1930s. Others weren't so sure. Some of them thought that race mixing was going to doom the U.S. no matter what. Others, the one guy in particular who was the main Nazi source for the understanding of American law, thought simply that there was a great competition or collision between two principles in the U.S., formalistic egalitarianism and realistic racism, and it wasn't clear which one was going to win out. That was his view.
I want to double back to that, because that egalitarianism and sort of the libertarian ethos that Nazis and Nazi and American law share a little bit. But I want to also, before we get there, I want to touch on the idea of a second-class citizen. We also provided a model for that as well.
You bet. So there were a couple of varieties of second-class citizenship law in the U.S. First, of course, there was de facto second-class citizenship for African-Americans. In practice, achieved in particular through restrictions on voting rights and things like that, which we're seeing again now in the U.S., that de facto form of second-class citizenship really couldn't have been a model for the Nazis. It was impossible to declare American blacks not to be citizens because the 14th Amendment guaranteed their citizenship. So American law had to use all kinds of subterfuges and workarounds and tricks in order to deprive blacks of meaningful citizenship. The Nazis were never going to do that kind of thing. They were just going to be completely open about their creation of a form of second-class citizenship. There was, however, another variety of second-class citizenship law in the U.S. In particular, Filipinos and Native Americans were classified as non-citizen nationals, Native Americans in 1924. There were also questions about what to do with Puerto Ricans and Hawaiians. The question of the Filipinos was the most important, though. That arose after American victory in the Spanish-American War, which made the U.S. a colonial power for the first time. And American lawyers, the Supreme Court in particular, created a special category called non-citizen national to deal with Filipinos. That, strikingly, is the same category that showed up for Jews in the Nuremberg Laws. Now, I mean, I don't want to claim, I can't show you that there was that was a direct borrowing from the U.S., and I wouldn't want to push it that hard. But they certainly talked about American second-class citizenship law a lot, and regardless of whether there was a direct borrowing, there clearly was a sense of inspiration or readiness to welcome the existence of another parallel regime.
And so just to be clear, for folks who aren't clear with the terminology, de facto is that it's not explicit. It is sort of like you say, backdoor policies that
right.
sort of skirt around the law. De jure would be specific laws that are very
That's
explicit
exactly.
and do it. And,
right.
and so when they look at the creation of second class citizens de jure from a de jure standpoint, are there sort of intermediary steps that must be taken? In other words, you know, we have certain qualifications, certain criteria that we set up that are philosophically grounded in this. These people came to this country, and we have an association with them, but they haven't been citizens in the past. I mean, I know that in Germany, there were emancipatory laws in the 1880s that allowed essentially Jews to assimilate into society. What did these Nazi lawyers sort of go back and say the methodology in which they came into society is similar to the way that Filipinos were welcomed to, you know, the United States mainland, not as citizens? I mean, what is the sort of intermediary steps between this is the situation we have is the status quo now, this is where we want to get to? What do we have to legally find about the Jews or the Gypsies or whomever it is that we want to make second class citizens? Are there intermediary steps that must be taken to get to that classification?
Sure, although that's a great question, if I may say so. You're right, the same problem does present itself with the Filipinos, who were a conquered people who had not previously been integrated into the population. The answer to your question is that, yes, you have to have some means of stripping people of citizenship. The Nazis didn't make a whole lot of heavy weather about that. They just did it. What is true more broadly in immigration law in this period, really throughout the Atlantic world, is that there was a lot of citizenship stripping going on. So in the U.S., communists would be stripped of their citizenship. As a matter of the, for example, not all, obviously, by any means, but some. But you're absolutely right that something of that kind had to be done. As a matter of the politics in Germany, the first targets for the Nazis were Jews who had arrived in Germany essentially around the time of the First World War. They were the first to be stripped of citizenship, but of course it was easy to identify them as newcomers. It's only in 1935 that the indigenous German Jewish population got targeted the way it was in the, and legally, obviously, lots have been going on.
Right.
But in this respect, in 1935 in the Nuremberg Laws.
I mean,
they did face this problem and found it much easier to deal with the Eastern European Jews who had showed up relatively recently.
Yeah, I mean, I ask because I think it's really important that people understand that dynamic, that you know, we like to think like, oh, they're Nazis. Why wouldn't they just, they could just say like they're all illegal. But in fact, even they within the context of sort of the politics and to maintain some fealty to the, I guess, you know, the integrity of a legal mechanism, they've got to take this step-by-step process. Tell us a little bit about the clash between the juristic, I guess, moderates and the Nazi radicals.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that emerges very strikingly, in particular from the transcript of the June 1934 meeting that we mentioned before. There was a real clash there between Nazi radicals who wanted two things. They, first of all, of course, wanted a full-scale realization of the Nazi program, but they also didn't want to have to worry too much about the legal niceties on the one hand, and on the other hand, people who, strange as the phrase may sound, have to be called moderate Nazis. I mean, these were all nasty people. I say that not to defend them. They were moderates only in the sense that they really wanted to stick to inherited norms of the rule of law, didn't think you really could or should go as far as the radicals wanted to do. One of the striking things about that particular meeting, let me say one more thing about it, the moderates in particular had a sort of a quasi-official status at that stage in the German state. Hitler had come to power with the support of what we usually call nationalist conservatives, and there were plenty of them there in the bureaucracy, in the justice ministry. These were not Nazis, although they were certainly right-wingers of a very objectionable kind, and it was those people in particular, they included the Minister of Justice himself, who were insisting on norms of the rule of law, and in fact, in early June of 1934 at that meeting, they won the day. Only later in that month, after an event called the Night of the Long Knives, a couple of nights of mass murder, did it become clear that there was really not much hope for anything like a moderate program.
And the moderates would argue too that the moderation is not they're not looking for moderation on any type of like moral grounds, but more on durability of a regime, right? I mean that you need to have it grounded in societal laws.
Absolutely. There also was a sense among them that, for example, something like criminalizing interracial marriage was just outside the norms of civilization. You couldn't do something like that.
Even though that's happening in 30 states in the United States.
It's happening in 30 states in the U.S. Although it's very interesting when the justice minister presented that fact about American law, he added, but we don't know if they really do it. We can't believe they actually do this in practice, he said.
I mean,
he was wrong.
Right. And in fact, in 1935, there was a study tour by German lawyers to look at this sort of dynamic up close. But there's not a lot of there's not a lot of documentation of that tour.
Yeah, sadly. There was a group of 45 Nazi lawyers who came to study the United States. But I haven't been able to dig up much about what happened when they got here, although there are some stories to tell about their trip.
I feel like I heard once that they based their uniforms off of Massachusetts State troopers. I don't know if
did
it would
they
came.
Really.
I heard something
I
to that that it was that you know, I don't know if that was just apocryphal as I was growing up in Massachusetts, but maybe that was just something that high schoolers told each other when they were getting stopped for. Liquor, but I've heard that.
One does have to worry about the source if it's high school.
Yes. I just wanted to make that clear. All right. Lastly, I want to just talk about the sort of the ethos, the egalitarian quality that was sort of similar in Nazi and American law, egalitarian, but also limited in terms of where that concept applies to.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So here I'd like to emphasize something that's not obvious to most modern Americans. Egalitarianism is a tough sell politically. It's hard to get people to believe that everybody is equal and there aren't some superiors and some inferiors. And one of the things we see in both Nazi Germany and in the U.S., and by the way, also in other British dominions and other parts of the British Empire, is the tendency for egalitarianism to show up first as egalitarianism only for white people, and at the expense of others who are going to be excluded. And in that sense, historically, egalitarianism and racism really seem to have gone hand in hand. There's a memorable moment in the memoirs of John Quincy Adams when he's talking to to John C. Calhoun, and Calhoun says, you know, we have to have race slavery because it's the only thing that makes all the white people feel equal to each other. The Nazis had took much the same view of things. Their claim was really a strongly egalitarian one, that all Germans, even ones, poor ones, even ones of low, historically low social status, were all equally members of the master race. And that was a big part of how Hitler sold the program. But of course, you can only sell that program if the equal status of the superior race came at the expense of others. And that was the pattern you saw in the U.S. for a very long time. And, you know, hard as it is, as it may seem to swallow, it's the same pattern you see in Nazi politics in the 1930s.
Yeah, and what's also fascinating, and just as a programming note, next week we're going to play an interview with Richard Rothstein, who wrote about de jure discrimination against particularly African Americans in housing policy coming out during this era, really, of the New Deal, and his argument is that it was unconstitutional. But this was not an anomaly, let's put it that way, I guess, that the Nazis were able to find these laws to base their laws on, because to a large extent, this was U.S. society. In some respects, it was almost as if they were headed in different tracks to a certain extent, yes?
Yeah. Well, you may know Ira Katznelson in particular wrote a book about exactly the phenomena you're describing called When Affirmative Action Was White, about this period. In the background, there's a background fact that has to be emphasized, makes us a little bit uncomfortable, but the Democratic Party, especially in the early 1930s, was heavily dependent on the support of the segregationist South. For that reason, the New Deal programs are often New Deal programs that make us pretty uncomfortable now for exactly the reasons that you've mentioned. This was a time of real uncertainty in American politics, and real uncertainty, particularly in the early 30s, about what form the New Deal was going to take.
Professor James Whitman, the book is, forgive me, I had it right in front of me, Hitler's American Model, The United States and the Making of Nazi Race Law. I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Fascinating book. We'll put a link, obviously, at majority.fm. And I got to look up. I swear to God, I thought that thing about the uniform.
There's a line in The Departed when Matt Damon
I got it.
I think it is. He has a desk job and a hired, you know, he has a job where he gets to wear a suit, basically. And his buddy from the academy has his like brand new trooper uniform on, and he does look totally ridiculous. And Damon's like, "You look like you're ready to invade Poland."
I looked it up, and there's nothing definite on whether it was based on it, but other people have heard that same story.
Yeah, it's out there. It's out there.
Also, I've recommended that Ira Katznelson book, When Affirmative Action Was White, before on the show. It's really good.
Well, you didn't put it in the guest list.
Well, it's a kind of an older book, but...
All right, folks.
You're so loose with yourself with that board, man. Very indulgent.
Was that indulgent?
That was a little indulgent. You definitely make Matt very bitchy, which is funny.
I do.
Yeah.
I do. You know what I needed there was more of like a Law and Order one. You didn't put in there. Bump, bump. You know, something like that. But
and bum, 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 bum.
Oh yeah.
For you. Where's that?
I don't have that one. I gotta update the board. All right, folks. Just a reminder: this show relies on your membership to continue. We will continue to endeavor to bring you interesting interviews like today, which I found fascinating. And we can't do it without your support. If you have the financial means to become a member, please head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. If you don't and you want the bonus material that we give to people who join up as members, but you don't have the financial means, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have some patience. We will get to it, and we will set. We will hook you up. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you're one of those people who registered to vote with podcast awards with an opportunity to vote for us in People's Choice or Best News in Politics, please do. Apparently, there's a limited number of people who are allowed to vote, and you have had to have registered, and you got an email, so check your spam thing. I don't know. It's not just a voting. It's almost like a scavenger hunt in some way. And so we could use your support, because I just don't know how many people.
They have Republicans running the voting system.
It sounds a little bit dubious.
Kovac's been working on it.
Yeah, no kidding.
Kovac.
Also, if you buy your stuff from Amazon or Jet.com, you can do so via our links at MajorityReportKickback.com. Check out TMBS, the Michael Brooks show. Some people have other names for it. And you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can go to patreon.com/TMBS to get even more BS.
At least like Brooke sprinkle like five, maybe like go 10-90 on like occasionally referencing the actual content.
I mean,
like this weekend, Corey Pine and I illicit history on Silicon Valley fascism. All right, back to it.
Like I say,
more BS.
You can also head over to YouTube and see and answer the question, did Michael wear a sport coat this week?
That's right.
Was the blazer in effect? So check all that out. We're going to head to the fun half, 646-257-3920. Folks, I will not be live again until after Labor Day. I don't know. Maybe I'll pop up on Twitter a little bit, or maybe on YouTube. But
just tweet. Just say, hey, I think that this Jimmy Dore video really lays it out. You'll lure him right out of vacation.
I don't even know.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. That's true.
I'm back on Twitter.
I'm back.
There's someone with
emergency an egg. Show. Emergency show.
There was someone with an egg picture, and they have 25 followers, and they said that Tim Black was right about mobilization, and I'm going to spend the next 48 hours.
No, I don't. That's
ignoring
not.
My family.
That's not the wheelhouse.
Oh, not Tim Black, excuse me. Jimmy Dore made a good video about Susan Sarandon, and they're wrong. I cannot watch. What is like? We got to do a video of like missing all of these like vital, like the first time. Well, like this would be before Jimmy Dore, but like the first time Saul walked.
Right.
You're in a Twitter
Sorry,
battle.
I missed that.
Mila
Sorry.
Graduates from high school.
Exactly.
Like, but with that like music that they put under all the iPhone commercials.
Right,
and stuff
exactly.
About how the phone is there for your greatest moments.
Except it's just Sam with his head stuck in his iPhone.
All you see
tweeting.
Is pictures of the floor as I'm just on my different carpets. Sidewalks. All right, folks. We'll see you in the fun half.